Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, the icy island of Greenland. Explorers first journeyed there in the hopes of crossing to the North Pole. Today, Greenland has become one of the Earth's largest laboratories, with scientists combing the island's ice sheets, looking for clues about the Earth's climate, both where we've been and where we're headed. Journalist John Gertner has spent the last 5 years studying Greenland, from the expeditions of long ago to the high-tech research of today. He tells these stories in a new book, The Ice at the End of the World. He explains why journeying into Greenland's past is key to understanding our planet's future. Johnny, it's good to have you with us. You start out the book by saying we can't begin to grasp the full implications of climate change without understanding what's happening right now in Greenland. First of all, most of us have never been to Greenland, so describe it for us.
Greenland is the world's largest island. It's several thousand miles from the mainland United States as well as from Europe. Most of Greenland's above the Arctic Circle. Just over 80% of Greenland is covered in an ice sheet. It's the last remaining ice sheet in the northern hemisphere from the last ice age. In the center of that ice sheet, it's about 2 miles thick. The ice is about 1,500 miles long, north to south, and about 700 miles wide at its largest point. And it's hundreds of thousands of square miles of ice. And really the crucial aspect now for us about Greenland when we think about this distant place that we might think has nothing to do with our lives is that it's melting. And it's really been melting at an accelerating rate over the last couple decades. And even this summer, earlier this summer in June, we saw that on some days, on some warm days, Greenland's ice sheet can shed as much as 2 million tons of ice and water into the ocean. And what that means really is that water that's coming off Greenland's ice is raising the sea levels. That's just one of the reasons I wrote a book about Greenland. But for the most immediate, I think, reason of why we should care about this place is that Greenland holds enough ice on its surface to raise sea levels about 24 feet. That's not all going to slide into the ocean anytime soon, but some of it, or a good portion of it, might certainly over the next decades and next centuries. And we're talking about a place that, you know, may pass a point of no return if we keep putting CO2 into the atmosphere, raising temperatures. And what the computer models tell us is that, you know, the future for places in the Arctic especially, which are warming faster than the rest of the Earth, are extremely susceptible to increases in temperatures. And as Greenland melts, there are certain feedback loops that kick in. And that's where we're at. The more Greenland melts, we're in danger of a situation where the more Greenland melts.
I gather Greenland is, what, 5 times the size of California? And there is a population there of, what, 56,000?
Yeah, it's the least densely populated nation on Earth. Antarctica isn't really a country. Antarctica would be first. But because Greenland's covered in ice, more than 80% of it is covered in ice, really the only habitable lands are these sort of slivers of coastline on the west coast especially, and some small settlements on the east coast too. But this is a very, very small population, and it's very sparsely populated. And what's interesting is that even though it's a kind of sparsely populated, immense, immense island, it's really become a kind of focus point for scientists from all over the world who come there during the science season, which really runs from spring or mid-spring, April to May to August, really to study not only the ice, but the culture, but also the rocks, the water, the runoff, the oceanographic sort of effects of all these things. It's become a kind of, as I said, sort of epicenter for science.
Interesting. What fascinates me is that, as you said, in some places, the ice is 2 miles thick. How do you know then that ice is melting. How is it measured?
Before I'd ever been up to Greenland and started studying it, I sort of thought of the Greenland ice sheet as a kind of, you know, skating rink on top of Greenland. It's not like that at all, actually. It has a lot of different textures and colors depending on where you are on the ice sheet. But most crucially, it's more like a dome of ice that covers the island. So on the coast, you may get sheer cliffs of ice as the ice sheet descends out into the water. But in the center of this ice sheet, it's much higher. It's about 10,000 feet in altitude. But really, if you think of Greenland as a kind of mystery that confronted explorers and scientists in the very early part of the 1900s, bit by bit, we've come to understand not only what the ice sheet is, but what secrets or mysteries it holds. Also its contours, sort of its thickness, how much water it holds, what might happen if it drips into the ocean or crashes into the ocean. And one thing early scientists tried very hard to understand was how thick it was in the middle. And they tried a couple of different techniques. The first was literally setting off small bombs. They call it a seismic technique, where you track the sort of explosion from the surface to the bedrock below, back to the surface as it bounces back from the bottom. And then you time that seismic wave. And by timing it, you can kind of figure out how thick that ice is. And that was really the first breakthrough to understand just how much ice there was in the 1930s. And after that, we can now do other things using radar techniques and the like. The takeaway from all this is not only knowing how much ice there is in Greenland, but that we can actually drill into it and use that thick, thick ice that's really a record of 100,000 years plus and find some ancient clues to how Earth used to be.
You said that this age of exploration began in the late 1800s. Two men on opposite sides of the Atlantic tried to cross Greenland.
In those early days, this is the pre-technological era, or sort of, you know, certainly pre-modern era, there was no way to really know what exactly was inside of Greenland. I mean, you could kind of go to a mountain at the edge of the ice sheet and look as far as you could, but you couldn't fly over it. And there were all sorts of wild theories that maybe there was a kind of oasis in the middle with deer frolicking and birds and palm trees, you know, some of these fanciful ideas. And it became, along with the exploration or attempted exploration of getting to the North Pole and the South Pole and the Northwest Passage, all these sort of things that would ring a bell for people who read about expeditions and these early adventures, one of these early sort of notions was maybe we can cross the Greenland ice sheet and find out what's inside or what's in the middle. And this was an idea that took hold first of a young Norwegian scientist named Fridtjof Nansen. He first got the idea in the early 1880s, and then he actually did it in the later 1880s. And he and a couple colleagues literally pulled sleds up this big dome of the ice sheet on one side, and they skied down the other side.
Wow.
And it was absolutely miserable. He was a very gifted writer as well as a brilliant fellow, but the ordeals they went through were just horrific. And a couple of years after Nansen, an American, Robert Peary, decided to make an even more ambitious crossing of the ice sheet in a northern part. So Nansen had done it in the southern part. Peary was going to do a sort of effort at one-upmanship and cross it in the north. And his technique was a little bit more modern. He was going to bring dog teams. And when you bring dog teams, one advantage is you can go faster, but the other is you have to bring more food for the dogs. Mm. He succeeded too, but his crossing was even more miserable than Nansen's. So these were, you know, extremely difficult endeavors. They were kind of the beginning, in some ways, of the age of science. Nansen was a scientist. Peary was not. But what their work did, in a way, was sort of open the door for scientists to kind of start looking at the ice sheet. And in fact, some of these men brought teams of scientists who would make scientific investigations as they sort of went on their kind of heroic exploits.
And in addition to what I presume were frigid temperatures, You write about the incredibly terrifying crevasses. Can you explain those?
Greenland's ice sheet moves. You know, gravity pulls it down at its edges. One of the analogies some scientists use is that, like, you might think of pancake batter, where you pour it from the top and it spreads out the sides.
Right.
And in this analogy, snowfall is the batter. And every winter and spring, snowfall replenishes the Greenland ice sheet in the center, and gravity pulls that ice slowly down the sides. And as it kind of pulls down towards the sides, it runs out through these rivers of ice we call glaciers, but it also kind of fractures apart, and it cracks and stretches. And that's beautiful when you're flying over it, but when you're actually climbing over it, it's unbelievably treacherous. And what makes it worse is you might be walking and there might be a recent snowfall that covers over one of those fissures, one of those crevasses.
Huh.
And all of a sudden you're walking and you find yourself, if you're lucky and your instincts take over, up to your armpits in snow with your legs really dangling over nothingness.
Wow.
Some of these fissures go down many, many hundreds of feet. And in fact, some of the folks I studied, some of the scientists and explorers really had, you know, some terrible accidents down there and, in fact, some deaths.
That's what I was going to ask. So, John, tell me when it was first recognized that if Greenland were to melt, even slowly, that there would be dramatic effects worldwide.
The first, I think, realization that I came across that this was at least a conceptual possibility was right after some scientists did those early seismic experiments to try and figure out just how deep the ice sheet was around 1931. And they calculated, okay, well, if Greenland has enough ice to raise sea levels a certain, you know, 25 feet, they were off by a little bit. But we also have to remember in that era, there was no real sense that the Earth was warming or that we were on this trajectory towards where we are now, which is really, I think, a very kind of worrisome place. And although some early researchers raised that alarm by that, even by those early dates that, you know, industrial emissions and CO2 could warm the atmosphere, this wasn't really a kind of reality-based forecast that if Greenland would melt, that it would raise sea levels this much. So that was an early, I would say, understanding of the volume and mass of Greenland's ice, but not necessarily an understanding that the implications were real, that they might have, you know, not just scientific interest, but actually real human and social and cultural and economic importance. And, you know, of course, that's where we are now, where Greenland loses hundreds of millions of tons of ice per year. Antarctica also, which has even more ice, is starting to accelerate its melting. And where we can look to the future and say, okay, this isn't any longer just an idea or hypothetical. This is something real.
So explain just what it is that happens as this ice begins to melt.
The Greenland ice sheet kind of loses ice and mass in a couple different ways. Because it flows outward from the forces of gravity, giant icebergs calve off the edges, off of these glaciers that kind of meet at the ocean's edge. And some of these icebergs are tremendous, you know, icebergs that are the size of the New York Public Library or the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah.
So about 50% on most years of Greenland's lost ice comes from glaciers and from icebergs. And these icebergs float out to sea and eventually melt, and they raise sea levels by tiny, tiny increments. And the other way that Greenland loses mass is every spring and summer, especially right about June and July, when it peaks in later July. And these are these meltwater lakes and kind of these azure rivers that flow off the top of the ice sheet, and they flow out into the water at the edges. And about 50% of Greenland's ice is lost this way, too. It's what they would call surface melt, the scientists. And this combination on a given year can lessen the mass of Greenland's ice from anywhere from, you know, 150 million tons on a year when there's not much ice lost to anywhere up close to 500 million tons in a year like 2012. There's some speculation that 2019, too, will be a year of very, very high melt. And there are some slightly esoteric reasons for that. But in a sense, the ice sheet is vulnerable to a warm summer this year because it doesn't have much snow cover. It's absorbing a lot of solar energy, and that kind of hastens the melt.
So why is the ice melting at so much more rapid a rate?
If you ask a glaciologist, you know, what's going to happen to Greenland in a warmer world, they'll jokingly say, well, you know, when it gets warmer, ice melts. And that's the simple answer. It gets a lot more complicated from there. And I think it's worth saying that, I spent a number of years writing this book on the history of glaciology in Greenland, but a lot of the science is really quite new. There were a lot of kind of mysteries about how ice sheets disintegrate or might melt in a warming world that we're really just kind of trying to unravel now. And I think one reason for that is that there's no sort of human experience of watching an ice sheet collapse. This is something that we know has happened in the distant past when these vast ice sheets during the ice ages covered North America and Northern Europe. And eventually, as the world warmed up, they shattered and collapsed into the sea and raised sea levels. I'm sitting here in New York City in a place that was probably under about half a mile of ice, 25,000 years ago. But nobody's ever quite recorded that and understood precisely what will happen or how an ice sheet will melt and collapse. So what we know now, as I mentioned, was that we know, for instance, Greenland is losing mass through its glaciers at the edges and through surface melt. What's also become very clear is that ocean temperatures have a very, very powerful effect. We might think, warmer air will melt the ice, but oceans can do, and surrounding seas can accelerate how fast glaciers kind of break apart at the at the edge, almost like a control knob. And as the oceans warm up, it seems that the glaciers speed up and start dumping ice into the water. And as one scientist had told me, he said, to a glacier, 33 degrees Fahrenheit is really warm. So even these tiny, tiny incremental changes in temperature for the ocean can have really profound effects over time on these ice sheets. And we're seeing that not only in Greenland. I've also written about glaciers in Antarctica that seem to be accelerating and which have really the potential to kind of dump, billions and billions of tons of ice into the ocean and raise sea levels substantially.
More with John Gertner on his new book, The Ice at the End of the World, when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here is the rest of my conversation with author John Gertner. How did World War II and the start of the Cold War change perspectives on Greenland?
The Cold War and the birth of modern glaciology happened at around the same time, and they were interrelated, actually. The United States set up military bases in Greenland right in the early 1940s as Germany occupied Denmark. Greenland was a quasi-colony of Denmark. And the idea was that nobody wanted the Axis powers in Greenland. There seemed to be a certain strategic importance in Greenland. For one thing, it seemed to offer a kind of rest stop for airplanes going to Europe. It was also deemed important because, correctly, they believed it influenced weather patterns that eventually moved over to Europe. And Nazi Germany actually tried to set up weather stations on the east coast of Greenland. There were these minor skirmishes, but the notion was that you could interpret what the weather might be a few days before it hit in Europe, and you could even schedule, battles or convoys. And in fact, some of the northern Arctic forecasts coming out of U.S. scientists stationed in Greenland were used for our planning of D-Day. But coming out of the war, we still weren't investigating the ice sheet, and climate change was not even on anybody's forecast at the moment. What was really important, actually, was the Cold War, and the United States had already set up some bases in Greenland, and the Cold War strategists at the Defense Department believed that certainly in the coming decades, the greatest struggle would be between the United States and the USSR, and the most direct line of battle was through the Arctic or through Greenland. That was the most sort of direct line from Moscow to Washington. So we made huge investments in Greenland. We built one of the largest air force bases in the world called Thule Air Force Base in northwestern Greenland. And out of that, there were these small divisions in the Army Corps of Engineers that were tasked with, you know, how should an Arctic war be fought? What kind of science do we need to know about snow and ice to say, you know, build airfields on ice, or to understand how troops should best fight and move around over ice sheets? And this became a generously funded program of the U.S. military, and there were different scientists working on it, and one in particular who I write about in my book was a Swiss-American scientist named Henry Bader. And Henry Bader was a genius at sort of using this unlimited Cold War money both to answer questions that the military had about fighting or preparing for battle in an Arctic environment, but also for sort of assuaging his curiosity about ice in general. And he eventually kind of used some of that money to really pursue something that was of deep, deep interest to him, which was trying to drill into that deep, deep ice sheet and sort of extract what we now call an ice core that could, in his belief, you know, measure ancient temperatures and would contain ancient records from long, long ago.
I wonder about the people who live there now after the establishment of U.S. bases in Greenland. Is the population primarily military or the offspring of military?
When the U.S. built Thule Air Base, there were some local Inuit populations living nearby. And, you know, there are chronicles of what happened precisely in the early 1950s when this massive air base was being built. And really what were, you know, almost, I think, 10,000 workers that were brought to the area to build literally a small city overnight. And yes, there were these sort of cultural insensitivities, I would say. What eventually the Americans did, and, you know, certainly I think a controversial idea that has had some repercussions, was move the local Inuit population dozens of miles north of the airbase to a new small town called Kanaq. And that's where the small local native population still lives today. Some of those folks do work at the airbase. But yes, it's a complicated and I think culturally sensitive issue. I think if it were done in the modern age, it would have been done differently.
So when did the glaciologist really begin to realize just how quickly Greenland was warming?
This has been, I think, a really recent development. And I say recent in the sense that, you know, a lot of our sort of understanding of physical laws and chemistry and, you know, electrical properties of matter can date back hundreds of years to some extent. But understanding glaciers in a place like Greenland really only goes back about 15, 20 years.
Huh.
And I talked a little bit before about drilling into the ice. Well, drilling into the ice, what that does is it gives you a record of the past, and it tells you what happened on Earth a long time ago. But it doesn't give you any information about what might happen in the future or exactly what's happening in the present. So to do that, really what scientists had to do was measure the ice sheet. And this is a really difficult problem. You know, it's kind of like walking into a field and counting every blade of grass. You know, it's this massive thing, and you can't stand in the middle of it and sort of say, okay, it's losing ice or it's gaining ice. And they had to figure out a way. And really, the first attempt to do this could only be done by airplane. And today it's done by satellites. But the first effort was this idea that why don't we fly a plane over precise routes of Greenland and use a special tool called a laser altimeter that will measure the height of the ice below. And we'll fly over it 1 year and we'll make all these measurements. And then we'll do it a couple years later and we'll find if the height of the ice has decreased or increased. And if you're flying the exact same route, you can sort of measure the difference. You can say, okay, the ice sheet has gone down by 4 or 5 feet. And you could do all these really complex calculations to try and figure out just how much ice has lost. And NASA did that with a mission, an airborne mission called Parca, in the early 90s. And again, in the mid-90s, they flew over it. And in the late 1990s, they published a paper in the journal Science and said, you know, Greenland is losing a lot of ice. And this was the first calculation of an ice sheet. So really only about 20 years ago. And after that point in time, we've put up different kinds of satellites in the sky that have given us a kind of week by week or almost month by month ability to measure these ice sheets. And that has helped us understand, you know, how many tons of ice this place is losing every year. And these numbers I cite are really, you know, NASA satellites that aren't really household names like GRACE, which stands for Gravity Recovery Experiment, and ICESat-2 and ICESat-1. These were really large breakthroughs because they allowed us, you know, we're very small, and to go to an ice sheet, which is very big, but it allowed us kind of these eyes in the sky that could measure things that we couldn't really grasp on the ground.
So what is your thinking about the massive coastal flooding that could take place? You talk about the year 2100.
Yeah. Any discussion with scientists who study ice sheets also gets into this notion, okay, well, not only how much ice will these places lose, but how fast will they lose it? That's really the more crucial question in a way. Sometimes it's easier to, you know, plot a computer chart several hundred years into the future than it is to try and figure out what changes will happen, say, within the next 50 or 75 years. But for all that said, the year 2100 has become significant in many ways. It helps us understand what kind of buildings we should build on the coasts to withstand encroaching seas. I think in a more conceptual sense, our youngest generation will glimpse that year. And this is a world that is the future for the youngest amongst us. And the numbers can vary. There's no one consensus, anywhere from 2 feet of sea level rise on the coast to anywhere upwards of 6 feet. There are some outlier predictions that might go as high as 10 feet by the year 2100. And one reason it's so hard to predict is we don't know how we will act. We don't know how our policies and politics and technologies will change to try and change the trajectory we're on. These ice sheets are very sensitive to warmer temperatures and warmer oceans, as I mentioned. If we don't do anything, if we continue to, you know, pump out CO2 emissions and rely on fossil fuels as much as we are now, we could get, you know, very, very severe warming. And in turn, all these ice sheets will end up, I think, at the higher end, certainly, of those projections of sea level rise.
You currently have a president in the White House who does not acknowledge that human beings are in any way responsible for the acceleration of global warming. How much of an impact could that have as we go forward trying to find solutions to the problem?
It's a very discouraging moment. I don't think I can sugarcoat that. I think that when we look to the federal government, it's moving in the wrong direction almost every which way when you talk about climate change. So we could, you know, look, for instance, at Donald Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement that was hammered out a couple of years ago. 80 countries or so pledged to, you know, limit emissions so that temperatures would stay at 2 degrees Celsius above industrial temperatures, which is a kind of crucial benchmark. So that's a fundamental concern that we're not going to honor it, or that our president doesn't think we should. And this could have, you know, really significant implications. And we can even look at very specific things, such as telling the automobile companies in the United States that we're going to not impose large miles per gallon limits on the cars you produce. And that's a huge problem as well. You know, certainly the higher the efficiency of the automobiles we produce, the less the emissions. So I find it daunting. I think it could have very significant impacts. I take encouragement out of the notion that we have a lot of initiatives on a state level that are very, very positive. We can look to a state like California, where they're making, I think, really enormous strides towards regulations and technologies that will, you know, make sure that that economy at least runs on clean, renewable energy. New York State just pledged to meet certain agreements in 2050. So as much as it is, I think, a dark moment, there's a lot of points of hope. I think we can't deceive ourselves that, you know, this has to be a kind of widespread movement. I hope we get there in the next couple of years. And if there's one overarching thing that does make me sort of believe that things can change, it's to look at the younger activists, people of a younger generation, my kids' generation, who are really of the belief that this has to change, and that certainly the older generation of politicians and policymakers haven't done enough to ensure a safe future for the younger generation.
So interesting, as you talk about the steps that both California and New York are making, here you have politicians in Oregon running away from legislation, running away from voting on anything that could slow the acceleration of global warming. I think there remains in the minds of some the idea that there will be some magic bullet that's going to take care of all this and stop in its tracks global warming. Do you have any such hope?
I think it's a perfectly apt point that what's happening in Oregon is just so amazing to me that we could sort of look at all the science and all the concerns of policymakers and people who look at the environment and think that this doesn't need some kind of action. I believe that we have a lot of the technologies already if we want to make some really giant strides. It's not going to be easy, but I do think we can avert the worst impacts of a warming world if we act quickly, rapidly, energetically, to deploy certainly a lot of the renewable technologies that we have already. And it's why California and New York believe that they can hit these ambitious targets. I don't believe that these things will take care of themselves, not for a second. I would never classify myself as an optimist about what our chances are, but I think we can be pragmatic, and I think we can deploy, you know, clean energy technologies, clean energy transportation. I think we can build all our buildings and houses in a way that's certainly more energy efficient. I think these can make enormous, enormous improvements on what the world will be like 50 or 75 or 100 years from now. I don't think that we should listen to the techno-optimists who just think this stuff takes care of itself. It takes care of itself by governments investing in that kind of technology, whether on a state or local or federal level. And it takes place, I think, because also we make investments in the science and technology of the future through, you know, innovation and research that not only says, you know, we have the proper technologies to change our ways, but also that we can keep improving them, which is also necessary, especially when we look at the world, you know, growing in population and growing in energy consumption.
John Gertner, thank you for your work, and thank you for this book, which I hope a great many people will read and study seriously. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dan.
That's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Look for past podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereem.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Sandra Baker, and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urich-Lipker and Josephine Naonai. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.